Hello, everyone. This is Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Good to have you all with us. And we are going to have an interesting conversation coming up, one that I've been looking forward to for a while. We knew, this is a tape program, we knew that Silvia Federici and George Cafensis were coming to Baltimore to talk. And so we maneuvered to make sure that we all could fit our schedules in to make this conversation take place. Silvia Federici is a known revolutionary thinker, feminist author, agitator, for want of a better term. And her latest book is Revolution of Point Zero, that collects 40 years of research and theorizing about the nature of housework, social reproduction, women's struggles, and rethinking it to provide an alternative to the capitalist institutions and relations. And George Cafensis' new work is called In Letters of Fire of Blood and Fire, Work, Machines, and Value, a collection of essays that draw upon a careful reading of Marx's thought to educate political concerns encompassing this 21st century capitalist world we all live in. And they've been talking around town and have joined us in the studio on their way through, and good to have you both with us.
Okay. Thank you for inviting us.
It's great to have you both here. Hope you're enjoying Baltimore. So I thought we'd begin, because I want people to understand philosophically and theoretically where the two of you are coming from, because I think many people listening to us out there right now have no idea what this broad notion of this autonomous Marxism means in the 21st century, what it means anywhere, because people are not just involved in that kind of political life. You know, they may be involved in struggles to better their communities and to fight for their own rights and their children and clean water and everything else, but this sometimes is a very foreign idea. So could you both describe a bit about what you represent?
First, the Marxism part. Well, basically saying that capitalism is a system of exploitation of work and of labor. And the Marxist tradition, starts with Karl Marx, but it actually, in fact, starts way before him in all the ways in which people were thinking against the system that takes shape in the 16th century. So there's a lot of anti-capitalist thinking that went on before then, and Marx brought it together in many ways. And since then, Marxism has had many different strands, as you might know.
Right.
But the autonomous part is another story. It's an adjective, so in that sense, it's qualifying the noun. It's a more complex story because it's a particular type of Marxism that basically takes as its starting point refusal. That is, there's a class struggle, and the working class refuses to do what the capitalist boss requires them to do in order for them to basically be part of, to live. And this has been an essential principle of the kind of thinking that eventually leads to the work that I myself am doing, where refusal, the negative aspects of struggle become primary in order for us to understand why things happen in a capitalist society. And in other words, if you want to find out why there's a change in the profit rates, if you want to find out why the doorknob is shaped in a particular way, it's important to look at the way in which not only people work, but also the way they refuse to work. Mm. And it's that other side that's really crucial. And if you only see the work side of capitalism, you'll not grasp what the dynamic of the system is. The dynamic is in response to basically the struggle that's going on. And so that kind of Marxism that I come from takes that as a starting point. And it takes the struggle as the first step in understanding anything that's happening in a capitalist society. And it's remarkably revealing. The minute I began to understand this way of thinking about it, it was like an epiphenomenon. It took my mind, and I began to look and see how everything can be understood on the basis of that struggle. And So that's the first thing that, in other words, there's lots of Marxism that is somewhat deterministic in the sense that they think that capitalism is going to end itself. But the view that I'm coming from is saying, no, if there's going to be an end, it's going to come out of this struggle, and it's going to be coming out of a struggle that's more and more organized and unified and being able to express desires that go beyond capitalism.
A lot of this kind of way of looking at the world and capitalism, I mean, at least from my reading, Sylvia, comes out of where you come from, comes out of Italy, right?
Well, in fact, let me be precise.
Yes.
You know, autonomous Marxism, it's a type of Marxism that developed in Italy in the 70s. And actually, even before the 70s, there was a current of intellectual workers that was defined as operaism. Operaism means, I don't know, I guess it could be translated as workerism.
Mm-hmm.
It came out of a rejection of basically the type of ideology and politics associated with the Communist Party. It was really a revolt, in a sense, against communism as it had been defined in Italy. It was an attempt to basically reread Marx, reread, you know, from the point of view of the struggles, mm-hmm. you know, the people were making. This was a movement that began in the early 60s, at a time when in Italy you have the, you know, revitalization of working class struggle, particularly around Torino, the Fiat, the auto workers.
The auto workers, right.
You know, after a long period of repression in the 50s, after the war, the 50s was very repressive in Italy as well, not only in the United States. And that, of course, that movement went through many different changes. And in the 70s, you have the development of what was called autonomia, which was, in fact, a kind of offspring of operaism. But let me say this,
mm-hmm.
that autonomous Marxist is a label that people have put on me. It's not a label I put on myself.
Okay.
Because I do, I've learned very much from those currents of thought, from Italian operaism. It's been very important for me. I've learned a lot from Marx, and I use Marx in my work because I think that the kind of analysis of capitalist society, capitalist relation, that Marx has produced is still very important. We need to go beyond Marx, however.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's been an important part of my work to show that we need to go beyond Marx. And I think that, in fact, my feminism, you know, my activities in the feminist movement has been very important for me to see how much we need to go beyond Marx, particularly in that, you know, Marx's conception of work, Marx's conception of the revolutionary process, the class struggle, it's very limited in my view because Marx has always seen as work only the work that takes place in the factories, in the industrial proletariat,
right.
or the more generally wage labor. It has not seen all the unpaid labor, for example, that women have performed in the home, which has been labor extremely important, you know, in maintaining the capitalist process of accumulation. Because what we call housework or domestic work is really work of producing workers, work of producing on a day-to-day and generational basis, you know, the working class, the workforce, people's ability to show up the next day to the factory after they've been or in an office or in a school after they've been consumed, you know, in the work process. So that important limit, you know, in Marx, I'm not suggesting it's the only one.
Right.
Which is very, very crucial because, you know, I've discovered coming from a feminist analysis of capitalism that, in fact, the area of unpaid labor from which the capitalist system has been able to build, you know, its power, it's immense. Far more than Marx imagined, you know. Let's think of slavery, the plantation, colonialism.
Right.
And to me, to connect with understand the function of women's unpaid labor has been able to connect me, to see that our struggle was connected to the struggle, you know, against all the forms of apartheid and all the plantations that capitalism has built in its history. So in that sense, I'm beyond Marxism, though I use Marx and respect his work.
And I think that what Will said is really very important, and I'll maybe come back to it a bit later, because I think that one of the things that where all this – where Marx failed, but there's the limitations of his own kind of consciousness and being a European and where he was at that moment and being a man, not seeing other things, was how racism and race and colonialization and that exploitation and exploitation of women were huge factors in society that also caused a split of movements.
Yes.
To make change, because we didn't understand how critical race was and how critical the question of women, women's struggles were to this, to the change in the earth. So I think that this is an important point for us to kind of figure out how to come
into
a conversation, more than a conversation,
because,
but to organize around.
And the question of the class struggle, you know, Marx has not seen that, for example, for women has been very important. Many times the beginning of the class struggle is fighting against men, because if your husband or if your father does not allow you to go out at night, you know, you cannot even go to a meeting, etc. And the same thing also, you know, for black people, has been a struggle around against the hierarchies that have been built, racial hierarchies that have been built through the organization of work and the organization of space, the organization of society. So that, you know, conception of the struggle, you know, you don't find it in Marx. It was a way of racism, it was a way of slavery, but it was never really the center focus of Marx's work.
And to me, one of the things, I mean, let me start with you again, Sylvia, if I might, just, and then we can go back and forth here, is that one of the things that I was thinking of, that I was in terms of your work, is that they have this connection between, because this might sound strange to some people, but there's this connection you make between kind of the women raising families, that social reproduction, the reproductive nature of women, and that kind of goes to the heart for you of the reproduction globally. I mean, an exploitation globally. You see that you see this connection there that is a direct line.
Yes.
Right? A link.
Yes. Because, for instance, you know, there is a connection when between the reproductive work, you know, the women in an industrialized society do on a day-to-day basis, and the work that women do, for instance, in society where you still agricultural labor is still very dominant. In many countries of Africa, for example.
You spent a long time in Nigeria.
Yeah, I spent some years in Nigeria, you know, on and off. And in those situations, for example, the day-to-day reproduction involved working the land, particularly subsistence work, you know. So cultivating the land is very much part of what it is, you know, important. And, you know, it's very clear, for instance, that in the 90s, when so many countries across the world, particularly former colonial countries, you know, were really put to the ringer and still are, you know, through this economic policies imposed on them by the World Bank, structural adjustment, you know, economic liberalization that demonetized, you know, produced immense process of currency devaluation, you know, losses of jobs, and in many cases land expropriation, that actually the work the women did, the subsistence agriculture the women engaged in many cases, was the difference between life and death for many people, was what allowed many communities to reproduce themselves and not be able to be completely at the mercy of these forces that were coming from the World Bank, the IMF, and the World Trade Organization. So that, in that sense, I think reproduction, you know, and is the point zero, you know, for the changing of our life, because it's on the ground of reproduction that we begin to, first of all, guarantee our survival, but also create the type of relationship that can actually support us give us the kind of solidarity that enable us, you know, to confront, you know, these forces that are now coming so strongly against us.
I think that it's kind of critical to make this line between what you've been writing about, between the struggle of women and the beginning of capitalism and where we are now, to the destruction and control of literally the Earth's reproductive forces.
Yes. In fact, the question of the environment.
Right.
I think that coming from reproduction, you see the continuity between all this movement. You see the continuity between movement having to do, you know, with the domestic work and moving having to do with land reappropriation, land reclamation, and to oppose, for instance, the fact that land should be food production should be only for the market, and also the land to protect the ecosystem, you know, which now is being completely poisoned every day and destroying everything that produces life. So this, you can really see the continuity, and our task now is how to bring these different movements together.
And I want to talk about that. But yes. That's, I think, an important step to make. And I was thinking that something you described in one of your books, before we jump into that, and ask George to come in on that, is that one of the things you described in your book was one of your writings. I forget which one it was, but you talked about Nigeria. Mm-hmm. And about the Delta region, is the Oromo people who live there in
Ogoni people.
Ogoni people. Thank you very much. Ogoni people who live there, and that there was a time maybe 60 years ago where you could just dip your hand in the water and pull food out. The fish, not that long ago.
Yeah.
Now you can't,
yeah.
And it was done in the instant. And I think about where you are now, in Baltimore, and the Chesapeake Bay. When the Europeans got here, the Chesapeake Bay, you had to move your ship and canoes, whatever you had, around because of the mounds of oysters and all the that were out in the water, and the sturgeon swimming around, and all that native people. Mm. Literally just had to go out and pick the food and bring it home, and that was it. And that's totally gone. And it only took, 20 years for this to happen? 50 years, where that number is, in Nigeria.
Yeah, it's so crucial, because there is this illusion that capitalism has really brought wealth to the world. And I've become convinced through all the historical work I've done, and today, looking at what is happening today, every day, the destruction is immense. And the idea that capitalism has brought wealth and what has destroyed, we have forgotten, you know, what kind of paradise most of the places were. Like I described, the Delta. Imagine the Delta.
Nigerian Delta, right.
Yes. It's a place where thousands and thousands of little rivulets, you know, before the Nile, the water goes, the river goes into the ocean. You have all these different rivers, and each of them was full of fish. And the area around the soil was so fertile. So it produced bananas, mangoes, every cassava. But above all, it produced, you know, what they call manioca, like the big tubers that became part of the daily diet. And that now has been practically destroyed. You cannot even eat the fish, you know, from the Delta.
Because it's been poisoned by the oil.
Because it's so polluted. Yeah. You cannot even eat it. It's so poisoned. And they use dynamite in order to do exploration work, which means that fish has been completely destroyed. And the cropland around, you know, it's also being destroyed by so many spills. They say now the Delta is probably one of the most polluted parts of the world. Mm. Right? So you have a population now whose all access to wealth that they could have to reproduction has been completely undermined.
And the thing is, we don't see that as a crime.
Yeah.
That's not considered a crime.
Yeah, and that is not, that's considered, it's business.
It's business, not a crime.
Yeah.
So one of the things I want to talk about just for a moment, because what you were just saying and what you raised a moment ago, George, is the idea, the theoretical basis that you all are talking about, and also the reality of what's happening on the ground. How, for you, does that turn into something that really opposes not just opposes capitalism, but organizes something that talks about a future. That how does that happen? How do you think it happens?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's extremely what you're saying important, because I don't think that we're going to have any success simply by a politics of opposition. Mm. Yeah. It's very important to resist the destruction that is taking place around us, destruction of the environment, destruction of human beings. Work destroys you in many ways. We now see that the work process in so many ways, you know, by the continuous lengthening of the work week, you know, and by the kind of production which is also so lethal, for instance, you know, the chemical production and other forms. But I don't think we can really rely only on oppositional work. We also need to begin to construct an alternative in every form of struggle that we make. We need to engage in those struggles, you know, with in mind the kind of society that we want to construct, and a society that is not exploitative, is not based on hierarchies, and a society where people are really beginning to develop bonds of solidarity and beginning to, in fact, think of themselves as commoners on this earth, right? As people who share the wealth of this earth and not compete with each other, which is what they're telling us we have to do in order to survive. I think it's refusing that perspective and inserting that perspective as the horizon of our struggle. It's really what today makes a difference. And I think this is already happening. It's not something only that some radical groups and so on are imagining. I think that this is now happening across the world in many, many different ways. You know, I've been mentioning the last 2-3 days something that I heard on, of all places, you know, on an ABC program, the ABC News at night, which is that in many parts of America now, you know, people are developing time banks, you know, the exchange of services right. outside of the market. Who would have thought?
Right, it's happening, you know, here in Baltimore.
Yeah. Not long ago, this was considered a very radical idea. But now more and more, as people access to money, to income, it's diminishing. And also people want to have a community. They want to have a relationship with others. They find them refusing that kind of isolation, you know, in which we have been forced to live. So we are using the concept of the commons. The commons is a very archaic idea, you know, when people, you know, in the Middle Ages were sharing land, cultivating land together, making the decision about, you know, how to cultivate.
As many indigenous people did in Africa and
many parts of the American continent still people have communal land, and we have seen that there is a big attack against that. Every form of, you know, collective sharing, collective management of you know, the resources that we need to survive is now very much under attack, and we are reaching into a world in which if the forces of business prevail, you know, we will not have access to anything. We will have to pay when we go to every beach or
right.
every park.
Or these bottles of water that we never used to have to buy.
Exactly. Soon we'll buy the air. Right. So for us, the idea of the commons is an idea that we are developing with many others, looking at the struggle that people are already making, which is today how we share the resources of this planet, you know, how we build forms of mutual aid, you know, and also how we break the isolation in which we live, which is very, very, I think, is what holds back many struggles, because there are many people are suffering, but they feel so paralyzed, not able to respond, you know, to the forces that are making their life miserable, and to begin to reconnect our lives is a precondition, you know, also beginning to reclaim, you know, the wealth that is being mm-hmm. taken away from us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is, and there, George, you were about to say what?
I just wanted to put a concrete point to this as well.
Go ahead, please.
Which has to do with just basically 2 weeks ago, I was in Mexico, in the southernmost state of Mexico, in Chiapas.
Chiapas, yeah, sure.
And I was there learning what the Zapatistas believed to be freedom and autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
And this was quite an extraordinary event, because more than 1,000 people were invited from all over the world to come to the land that the Zapatistas had, what they call, recuperated 20 years ago in their uprising, and now have created more than 100 villages and more than 100,000 people who are living in a communal way.
Mm-hmm.
And this is now for more than 20 years that this process has been going on, under great pressure from the Mexican state, from the landlords of the Mexican southern part of Mexico. They've been launching paramilitaries against them, but they've survived, and and I've come back with good news that it works, in the sense that there are now Zapatismo is not a marginal phenomenon, but is now in Chiapas a major way in which you live. It's not it's not, as Sylvia said, just something for a few radicals to do, but
right.
It's the way in which I saw. In this little village that I spent 5 days in, I saw dozens of kids around. These are Zapatista kids. These are the beginning of another generation, which is not assuming the kind of stupidities that are now common in our society, and now are givens, in fact. So they are a sign that certainly in Mexico, but increasingly in many parts of South America, there is a genuine, not only idea, but actually practice, anti-capitalist practice. Now, where it will go, whether it will be crushed, I don't know. But all I do know is that it's a reality. And this is a way in which the negativity is turning into a positivity.
Yeah, people.
That's what's happening right now. And in that part of the, if our listeners have a chance, because it would be really great to have people from Baltimore go, there'll be other possibilities to go to the world of the Zapatistas and experience it firsthand. See that this is no what they call Potemkin Village.
And it's not only them. And it's not only. I think that this is a very incredible experience, and the Zapatista is a very unique experience in that way. But that kind of, societal movement, that flourishing of all kinds of activities that are bringing people together, that are creating different forms of cooperation in the day-to-day reproduction. This is now happening in many different ways, around education, around land, around health, because I think there is a deep realization that this system cannot really provide for our reproduction. It's not only because, between that and, our health, our education, we have to acquire a lot of money, right? But also because the way health and education and our reproduction are conceived, they are always conceived so that we can go back to work, so that we can create forms of exploitation. And there's nothing wrong with work, but this question is work for what?
And what kind of work?
What kind of work? Work can be actually a very creative and joyful experience if it's done by people who choose, what kind of work to do, who realize that they work for their own benefit, who work for good purposes, not for purposes that divide them, and are certainly not work that is, enriches in this scandalously, a few people, as it is happening now.
I'm going to kind of pursue this a bit further, because it's really interesting, something that both of you have been writing about over the years. And I was thinking about Chiapas. I would love to go to Chiapas.
Mm-hmm.
I was there 47 years ago, 46 years ago.
Okay.
And there was a struggle there then.
Uh-huh, yes.
And to see what's come after that. period of time.
Yeah, struggles are not matters of a minute.
No, they weren't. The Indians were struggling there then, and that beginning was what...
It led to Zapatismo.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
So it would be lovely to see what has come of that.
Yeah,
over that.
Yeah.
Almost half a century. I guess we're all getting old. But
yeah. And also the temporal scope of struggles. We look at a riot and say, okay, it happened 2 days or 1 day or whatever. But actually, we're talking about very long-term struggles, and we have to understand that we're, in terms of participation, our participation is part of a very large movement that goes on in time for many, many years. And we often hope that, you know, the problems will be solved like that.
They won't.
They won't. And we have to be sober about it, especially us who are now elders of these movements.
Right, exactly.
We need to be able to explain these things. It's not a defeat if you don't win in the first few minutes of the struggle.
That we once thought it was.
Yeah, so we once thought we was.
So, you know, and I think that that's a very, very important point. I mean, you look at America today, and I think about this. This is not if you look at the people who like voted for the Democratic Party, let's say, and for Barack Obama, they're, and I'm not that they represent to me a growth in the country, because they voted for this figure because of what he represented in their minds, not because of what he is or they are. You know,
mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
And
they believe in a different way of living. And more white people have moved over to that and connected to that than ever before in American history.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of a groundswell people don't see. I think that's a bubbling up.
Yeah.
You know, it took a long time. It took hundreds of years to get to this point in this country. You know?
I was amazed the night that Obama was elected. You know, we watched the TV and he was amazed, you know, and we shared that emotion.
Yeah.
It was an incredibly emotional moment.
I was naive about what that meant, but it was emotional.
Yeah, it was very, very. And to see the faces and many white people too. And I thought something is happening in this country.
Right. Something is shifting.
Something is shifting. Yeah.
One of the things that you were talking about work, I think this is kind of important to get to. I'm going to come back to the kind of movement building you see happening, because I think that's really important, what you both see in your travels. But I remember once you wrote, Sylvia, about it was something about that women being liberated, well, they didn't use these words, but come from the home and going to the factory to work was no liberation at all. Something like that that you wrote about,
yes.
Right?
Right. Yes. Yeah, I think we saw, you know, in the women's movement, in fact, there was a big divergence in the women's movement as what kind of strategies to use. You know, there was an agreement about the problem, and many, many of us saw that the problem was really rooted in the fact that, you know, there was a life that we were destined to, and a life that promised no social power, and, you know, you get married and have a husband, have a kid, and we knew what the work meant and the sacrifices and the dependence, economic dependence. So many families thought that actually having a job outside the home would be the solution, right? And granted, by having a job outside the home, many women have achieved some autonomy from men, but not now, in terms of their life, in terms of their capacity to shape their life, or with regard to the world of employer, with regard to capitalism. Actually, today, most women have a life that is practically impossible because they are adding to the work in the home, also the work outside the home. And so they have a work week that is worse than the Industrial Revolution. And, you know, so many women I talk to are living in a situation of constant crisis. You know, in particular, when in addition to the house, in addition to the work outside the home, you know, you have a child who gets sick. You have relatives who are becoming elderly and you have to care for them. And, you know, and the fact that women have taken away job has not meant that the workplace, the outside workplace has changed. You know, there hasn't been really a change in the organization of work. For example, to make it possible for people, women and men, you know, to both have a job and have a family. That has not. So we are now in a real situation of constant crisis. It's not only the lack of money, the precariousness of access to a wage, but it's also the amount of work the people are doing. And I always talk about the amount of drugs the women are taking, right? They are the main drug users, consumers of antidepressants.
And to dull the madness.
Yeah, to dull the madness.
Right.
And also the children. The children are also very much victim of this situation. And again, the whole proliferation of mental disorders for children, which is something very new of the last 20,
yes.
All of a sudden these kids have every problem, attention deficit and hyperactivity. And, clearly is connected with the crisis in the family, in the home, with the work situation, with the anxiety, the depression that is now is so deep and pervasive in this country.
I mean, it's also a crisis of, what's this done for children, one of the things that drive children crazy is we've taken childhood away from children.
Yeah.
We've taken the wonder of growing into an adult, and we no longer have the communal settings where we were talking about in our show just recently, the problem of masculinity in the world. There are no longer places for men who would, whatever they would do, to work with the family and to hunt and to provide and to take out aggression in a different way in communal settings. That doesn't exist, and there's no rites of passage for we boys and girls that come through life and be children and then come to the place to understand adulthood and go there. Those have all been taken away.
Mm-hmm.
They're gone. We have nothing to hold us. Our centers taken away.
Yeah. In fact, we always say now we speak of community, but actually community is gone.
Right.
Because the way in which so many, certainly working class community with the relocation of industry and also with gentrification, the increase in the rents, so many people have been pushed out of the cities, like New York is an
it's
example.
It's happening here now.
Yeah.
Even here.
Where you were speaking
when
you were in Baltimore here to Red Emma's, that neighborhood is a neighborhood of working class people, and the art, big institutions are moving in, pushing out the working class, working class people. So far, we'll see if there's a struggle going on whether it's going to be black and white artists living in this community, or will it just be white artists living in this community? Hmm. So that all that, that where you were speaking is in the midst
of that struggle
at this moment.
Yeah, we have seen it in New York. In fact, even Brooklyn now, is now going through this stage.
So I want to ask you, I know that we're talking about work, and I want to talk about work a little bit more and then come back to what you both been working on about what the roots of capitalism, where it began from medieval to capitalism, which I think is really interesting theories you're working on.
Mm-hmm.
But I was thinking about looking at your history too, George. You started off in as a young radical in the zero work idea, right? Wasn't that part of where you started?
Well, I actually started in the civil rights movement. I got my first arrest at 19, I was part of the anti-war movement of the early 60s, and was part of, I suppose you call it, the new left of that time.
We all were.
We all were.
A lot of us were at that moment, right?
Right. Exactly. And but I was at that time a very conventional Marxist. I believed that capitalism would ultimately destroy itself in its own mechanisms, and I basically met a number of people who introduced me to this operaista or workerist perspective. And I, as I said at the beginning, I was very transformed. My understanding of Marxism and of capitalism was totally changed. So the first product of that transformation was the formation of a collective who had put out a journal called Zero Work. And it was an effort, it was mostly focused on the United States, because many people used to think that there is no class struggle in the United States. And we made sure that we could, it was almost like a symphony of different voices from different parts of the, from the auto workers to the mine workers to the postal workers to the students. It was like a kind of arc of struggles that were taking place in the United States. And basically, it was a struggle against the work defined by capital. And it was very much a an effort to see what the nature of that, of the crisis was. And it wasn't sort of an autonomous decline in the rate of profit, but was actually the product of a varied struggle, and especially a struggle on the one side of involving men and women, and on the other side a struggle around around race and the end of the type of super exploitation that especially the black communities in the United States were facing. This was 1975, so this was the moment before the great counterattack, or at the moment of the counterattack,
right,
which had as its one of its prongs the energy crisis, the unemployment, the beginning of the tremendous shift to the right that was taking place in the formal political world, the end of the notion of a welfare state. All these begin to happen at this time, and huge forces are unleashed at this time, and so the struggles did not have one ending. The struggles led to many, many different consequences, and since basically. We're talking now more than 40 years ago. Zero work. We're still working. So zero work. Zero work was a bit of an anticipation, but it was my first commitment to this type of thinking about capitalism and the working class.
So was there a contradiction between the notion of zero work, which you both talked about, and the idea that you helped develop, Sylvia, about that work in the home was work that needed to be compensated? Mm-hmm. Is there a contradiction there or not?
No, there's not contradiction. Actually, there's not contradiction, because I think, in fact, it was very interesting process to begin as a feminist. This was really the beginning of my understanding of what feminism really meant, you know, specifically the starting from classic feminist issues, you know, discrimination against women, the kind of expectation that are put on women. If you follow them up, you know, and trying to understand, well, where did this come from? And what is the story about housework? You know, what are these social expectations about being a housewife, you begin to discover, and this was the very, very important part of the process, you know, you begin to discover not only that this work that is always, considered non-work, it's actually the pillar, mm-hmm. you know, of the capitalist organization of production. Because if you don't produce workers, we always said, if women go on strike completely, the whole society comes to a halt, right? That was one of our slogans, I think is profoundly true. But we also began to realize that through the history of capitalism, this work that is so important, that is so vital, and in a way can be so incredibly creative, because what is more creative than producing other human beings, giving life to other human beings, raising children, prepare the new generation, right? In fact, they've been, in a sense, captured and, restructured so that it would fit the needs of the labor market, so that instead of producing people according to their needs, the community needs, the collectivity needs, you actually reproduce people so that they can actually fit certain forms of exploitation of their work, which means the part of the housework is a very important part, is disciplining, is saying, no, you cannot do this. not because necessarily it's bad for you, but because one day you're going to be able to accept this kind of discipline, and otherwise you will never find a job or you'll never be able to keep, et cetera, et cetera. So it was very liberating because, you know, this relation we call family relations, sexual relation, that we are trained to expect so much from them, to expect the happiness and satisfaction in our life. And many of us, married or not married, we were discovering that they were such a source of pain and contradiction and conflicts. And to begin to realize how, in fact, the family, in a way, the home, sexuality had been turned into center of productions. And to look at this relation as relations of production. It was liberating because we realized that our suffering was not due to our failure as women, but was actually due to the fact that, you know, this relationship had been structured in a particular way that was very suffocating, and that we were suffering from, especially women were especially imprisoned by them, you know, as unpaid workers, as women, expected to be centered in the home, but men too had also been in prison. That's why the feminism I subscribe to is never meant to be equal to men, because we didn't think that men were liberated. We didn't think that the position right. of men was an ideal position, that our dependence on them also enslaved them in a different way, you know. And so to begin to see that double character of reproductive work, you know, made it possible to think of refusing some of their work without feeling guilty, without feeling that we were bad women. You know? So the question of refusal of work still had a,
right.
which is not refusal of reproduction, but refusal of certain conditions in which our reproduction has to be organized and experienced.
And I want to get to this point. Before we conclude, this is really important to me to have you all lay out. I think that, especially, you know, the Caliban and the Witch that you wrote, Sylvia, and the work you have both been working on, the idea of what, and to explain also in the process, the idea of what this primitive accumulation meant and means, and what you see as the real roots of how capitalism began. What that meant and why it was, for you, especially Sylvia, in the work you've been writing, why it's wrapped around the exploitation of women and burning women and killing women and what all that meant. Because that, I think, when we look at the beginnings of this in medieval Europe, that's where it all began.
Yeah, I had to go back when I began. You know, I started trying to understand, you know, as part of my work as a feminist, trying to understand what was the origin, you know, of this discrimination against women, you know, because many were explaining them, oh, this is a kind of leftover of, you know, traditional society, pre-capitalist society. And I never accepted that argument, and I was not alone, because we knew that in capitalism so many things have been changed. So if how was it possible, if this was not work that capitalism profited from, you know, why they would have allowed it to survive, right? So I decided, well, this work must have been organized according to the needs of a capitalist system. So I began to do the historical work, and I kept going back and back and back. Then I realized I had to understand what was capitalism, that I was using always this term, and why capitalism? Where did it come from? What was the history? And so I realized I had to go before capitalism and go to Europe, the Middle Ages, and begin to understand. And, you know, I had done a lot of history classes, and I was always presented a time before the advent of capitalism as this very boring period where nothing was happening. There were the queens and the kings, and then there were the peasants, and it was always very... And instead, I discovered it was a world of incredible struggles. That, in fact, there was a great struggle against these feudal lords who were these little military bosses, you know, who occupied land and basically forced the peasantry to work on their land. And so I realized that actually through the Middle Ages and through the feudal period in Europe, there have been all these incredible struggles about the occupation of land, you know, struggle about against the power of the feudal lords, and that in a way this brought to a crisis, you know, the organization of work and power that had characterized the feudalism. And in a way, the beginning of capitalism, you know, was the result of many different strategies that the feudal class, you know, merchant, landlords, the church, right, began to implement to regain their power. And when you look about what were these strategies, certainly you begin to see that colonial conquest is a major one. The first thing that they did in order to recuperate their power was to try to expand by military means, you know, the areas of their exploitation. And so that's where you have the conquest. It's so, so important, which, in fact, you know, also was of the America. Yes,
right,
exactly.
Right.
Yeah, and then through that, you also have the beginning of a monetary system because they began to dig, you know, mine the gold, you know, for years and years and years after the conquest. You have all these rivers of silver and also gold coming into Europe, and that begins to create a monetary system and so on. And then you have also the separation. They found another strategy was, which is quoted by Marx, you know, separating people from land. Because in the feudal system, the landlords gave to the peasantry some land to cultivate. So in the feudal system, you always had access to land directly. People could actually feed themselves, as exploited, as miserable as their condition were. Right? They had access to land. In fact, many times they cultivated it in common. So they were very, in these villages, they were very strong, you know, bonds. Well, that was the first thing. The second strategy, together with the conquest, is actually pushing the peasantry in Europe off the land, you know, and forcing them to work for a wage. What is the wage? Right? It means you can reproduce yourself only for the period that you work. And then you're out. So, in fact, really intensifies, you know, the amount of exploitation, the wage system. It does also other things.
Right.
Yes, it divides people and so forth. And, well, this, of course, is a classical image that Marx presents of how capitalism begins. But I began to realize that that was not enough. That actually very, very fundamental, you know, was also the appropriation of women's bodies and women's labor. And in two ways, fundamentally in two ways. First of all, appropriating women's body for capitalism was essential because the body of women, they begin to look at the body of women as really like as a sort of instrument for producing workers, you know. Capitalism is a system that is different from all the others that have preceded it because capitalism places labor as the center for the production of wealth. You know, it's not how much land you have that determines your wealth. It's how many workers you can mobilize. Capitalism is very, originates. And, I think it's to do because of the labor crisis in the Middle Ages, that there is a kind of refusal of work percolating in the last part of the Middle Ages. But that's another. We could leave that aside for now. But there is this question of labor that from the 16th century, from the very beginning, when the proto-capitalist class begins to reflect on itself, this focusing on the question of labor. And so I make a connection in my work, and I don't think it's unfounded, that all the new legislation that comes into place in this period, that really begins to control the body of women. For example, penalize with capital punishment any forms of contraception. And the attack, you know, moved against women with the witch hunt, you know, which was one of the crimes of the so-called witches, was precisely to impede, you know, the conception of new beings. All of this has to do with this question, with this idea very strong in the beginning the proto-capitalist politician and economist, that the amount of workers that you have in a country is really the measure of the wealth of the country. And then the other part that is important is that with the advent of capitalism and of a wage system, what is considered wage labor, what is included, you know, into wage work is only a limited part of the activities, you know, that used to take place, you know, in the feudal world. The whole area of reproductive activity, what we call domestic work, right now is excluded from the wage. Right? And in fact, I show that through the 16th, 17th century, legislation were introduced in many towns in Europe that forbid women really to engage in wage work. No? So there is a fixation very early in the history of capitalism. There is a fixation of women into reproductive work, into domestic work, into the production of the new workforce, right? At the very moment when their labor begins to disappear as work, is not considered work any longer, and doesn't carry any remuneration. So the assault, the women, the degradation the women suffer with the advent of capitalism was far deeper, you know, than the male proletariat suffered. They lost the land, but women lost even more because they didn't even access, you know, to wage work, and their own body was now appropriated by the state. And then through the wage system, capitalism also organizes a whole division between men and women, because the wage more and more will give power to men, you know, to control women.
And also that period led to the that was the root of the real physical persecution of women.
Yes.
That's where it began, and that whole notion was exploited and expropriated out, exported out, I mean to say, to the indigenous cultures that were conquered.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
So that became the system of oppressing women just became part of the system worldwide.
Exactly.
People, I think the roots of misogyny are as deep as the roots of racism.
Absolutely.
They happen at the same time.
Yes, and they come from the same root. Because, you know, the attack on women, misogyny, and also the attack on people on the basis of the color of their skin, it's really a way of creating population without rights. You know, capitalism, and this is really, to me, an insight that what feminism has led me to re-understand capitalism in a different way. You know, the capitalism has to continuously... the capitalism is not a system based on wage labor. It's a system based as much on wage and even more than wage labor.
Which is why the basis of capitalism was slavery.
Yeah. And that's why capitalism continuously needs to produce people without rights, and continuously needs to find forms of racism to justify that exploitation. Because if you don't recompensate people for the work they do, then you have to invent, you know, stories about who they are to justify the particular misery in which they are, to justify them on the basis of their personality, of their physique, of their disposition, psychological disposition, et cetera, et cetera. So the whole roots of racism and misogyny, you know, are very, very tightly connected.
I do want to get one piece in here as well, which is Mark Henry, one of my producers, was telling me that in your talks, what you've talked about this, and I didn't know about it, so I'm going to bring it up. You two have been talking a lot about the role of debt.
Right.
In the 21st century and in the capitalist world. And you have a really interesting analysis of what you both think debt means now, as opposed to what it was before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You want to start, George? Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. I'll start. Yeah, what we've been developing is the notion of a debt economy. That, yes, there's always been debt, and there are many different kinds of debt for thousands of years. And within capitalism, capitalism begins with not only the primitive accumulation of labor power that Silvio describes, but also the development of a banking system that was partly the result of the transformation of silver and gold from the Americas. That was part of the formation of a capitalist class, of a creation of a class of people who had credit, really, and were able to go to banks and be in debt. And what eventually at first, the working class was not part of the banking debt, and workers had no property, and therefore they didn't have any collateral. So if they were to get into debt, they would get into debt with their friends or with their boss or with a local shopkeeper. But it wasn't with the banking system.
Right.
Okay. What begins to happen in the 1920s is that begins to change, that the working class begins to get a wage that starts to have a certain kind of stability and an expectation of growth so that they'd be able to pay off debts. And for the banking system, especially beginning in the post-war era, and certainly here many are kept out, women are, and African-Americans are, but the male white worker began to have access to credit. And as long as the wages began to grow and on a steady pace, and wages were rather secure, then the mortgage, the healthcare expenses, and so on, that often had to be basically funded by debt, they could be kept into line. But since the 1970s, wages have sort of flattened out or actually decreased, even though productivity has more than doubled since the 1970s. But what has happened has been that increasingly, in order to satisfy the basic requirements of life, health, housing, education, and
food,
increasingly, in order to satisfy these very basic requirements, one had to come into debt. And so this is the beginning of a debt economy, and this is why this period in history, why the 2008 crash showed a basic inequality in our society, which is that the debts of those powerful banks and insurance companies were basically written off, whereas the debt of the working class was in fact intensified, and the consequences of it, which involved millions of foreclosures and basically the defaulting of other millions on their student loan debts and so on, these were in fact sealed as a basic consequence of being in a debt economy. This is what it means. And so as a consequence, this period in history involves the beginning of another kind of struggle that has been, we've seen it in American history. American post-Revolutionary War history begins with Shays' Rebellion, which was basically a debtor's rebellion.
Right.
And basically, there was the populist movement, which was a farmers' rebellion, which had its roots in indebtedness. And in the Depression, there were some efforts to do things like penny auctions, where houses that were being foreclosed upon would be bought into auction, and the neighbors around them would basically intimidate anybody else who was going to go beyond one penny for that house, and eventually the house was put back into the hands of the original owners. These were struggles that we know about. What we're saying now is that the condition of debt in our society is now the basic relationship between the working class and capital, along with the wage relationship. And in fact, there's a very deep relationship between those two, between wages and debt, that we need to understand. And the struggle against debt must also include not only a reduction of debt to zero, but also the creation of an economy that doesn't require you to go into debt in order to live.
To survive.
This is really... Yeah. So it means the decommodification of education, decommodification of health, decommodification of the basic foodstuffs of life, and of housing.
So you see, in some ways, you also see that the debtors are a new class.
Well, not a new class. It's still the working class.
Right.
But it's a new form of
exploitation.
Unites
a larger group of people.
I would say that the debt is a terrain where a lot of people can come together and recognize the commonality of their situation. You know, whether their debt is to the credit card or with student loans or the many, many debtors are because of healthcare. They get into debt
right.
because of health or mortgages. That this can be a place where people kind of recomposition, you know, and it's very, very important. But I agree with George that it's important also to think of only, okay, it's not enough to say let's liberate ourselves of our debts, but also begin to create a society where we don't have to get in debt to begin with. And that is also extremely important. But definitely, you know, debt today brings together a lot of different people, a wage worker and a non-wage worker. And in fact, debt is one of the great, we call it one of the great organizers of wages and labor today, because it makes people to work much more. And, you know, it's a work of disciplining, you know, people with regard to work, what work you choose, how many hours, et cetera, what choices you make, because now you have this chain
right.
that
right.
forces you, follows you through years and years of your life.
And the debt itself has become a new currency for those of wealth.
Yes.
You can trade in debt, make money on debt.
Oh, yes.
Debt becomes a new way. You don't have just to...
Harvesting wealth, yeah,
right.
accumulation. Debt is now a big means of
debt
accumulation.
Debt is a new gold mine.
You
just bundle the debt, and that becomes your new wealth.
They take your piece of flesh. They're still taking the piece of flesh from people.
In slivers, but it all ends up in a pound.
Right. It's true. So, I mean, so, you know, in all these things you've been thinking about writing and talking to people, I wonder where that, you know, leaves you in terms of your thoughts about where all this is going. Hmm. You know, I mean, what do you see? What do you think?
I see this. It's, you know, comparing to when I started doing political work, having, you know, the idea that this world had to be changed. On some level, things seem far more difficult
mm-hmm.
and complex. You know, at that time, I was full of youthful enthusiasm, and I thought, oh, we are going to. Right? But at the same time, I also see that in some aspects, they are more easy. Because when I was 18 or 20, there was all this debate about the Soviet Union, and China. I think all that is gone.
Nobody cares.
I think there's a profound understanding all over the world. Wherever I go, I find people are really talking the same things. And people are simply saying, suffering, the same suffering. You know, the difficulty of really, you know, having any security in this life. You know, the difficulty of having, you know, your needs, most fundamental needs met, you know, in a way without having to slave and live with anxiety, etc. The sense of no future, because you don't even know at the rate in which we are going, what's going to happen to this planet. You know, and the sense of anxiety continuously, because the precariousness of people's life, you know, this expression like being thrown under the bus, how many times I've heard it
yes.
recently. And in that way, there is such a deep awareness that this system doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And we haven't even begun to talk about the millions in this country who are incarcerated.
Right.
And as I said, how it continues, has to continuously, you know, jail and create people who have no rights, you know, and use any means possible to prevent, you know, the threat that they see, you know, rebellious youth and so on, because this is what it is about. You know, they're jailing a whole population of young people that they are afraid are going to demand something more from life than what they want to give them. So in the sense, I think the people know. For us, the question is, you know, how we are going to basically create, bring together the different struggle that people are making. Not, I mean, not us, but I'm saying how all the different struggle are going to come together and, you know, regain that optimism that, yes, we can change this world.
The optimism is there. I can feel it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you both are right that capitalism no longer has the answers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No.
But I'm so happy the two of you came to Baltimore and were able to come by the studio here. Sylvia Federici and George Carfentis, it's good to have you both here in the studio. This has been wonderful. Thank you both very much.
Thanks to you for giving us the possibility to talk in your radio.
Okay, thanks again.
Thank you.